So I want you to just picture the setting for a second. It's the mid-1970s.
Right.
You're maybe 19, 20 years old. You've just stepped off a plane in Helsinki, Finland.
And it's cold.
It's cold, it's dark by 3 in the afternoon, and you're supposed to be communicating in a language that, I mean, the Foreign Service Institute calls a Category 3 language.
Which basically means it's exceptionally difficult for an English speaker to even get started with. It's
Exactly.
the deep end of the pool, you know, except the pool is frozen solid and you don't know how to swim.
Right. And for the group of people we're talking about today, that was just the baseline. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a really specific, very human collection of source materials. We've got this stack of personal memoirs, oral histories, all from missionaries of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who served in Finland roughly between 73 and 75.
And what's so fascinating about this stack to me is that it isn't a theological treatise. We're not here to, you know, debate doctrine or anything. We're looking at the sociology of it, the experience. We're looking at resilience, at cultural collision, the absurdity of
Oh,
bureaucracy.
for sure.
And then you get these really profound moments of human connection that just they happen in the margins.
It's the texture of life on the ground. We have stories about everything from like using saunas to evade middle management all the way to baptismal fonts running with rusty water. So, our mission today is to see how all these little anecdotes, they kind of paint a broader picture of
I
persistence.
think it's a case study in what they often call planting seeds.
Yeah.
The central theme running through all of this is the delay between the effort and the result.
Yeah.
You do the work today, but the payoff, the harvest, might be a decade away. Or, you know, it might be for someone else entirely. It really challenges that instant gratification loop you're also used to.
But okay, before we get to the heavy stuff, we have to talk about the culture clash,
Yeah.
because you can't talk about Finland without talking about the sauna.
Right, the sauna.
But in these memoirs, the sauna isn't just about getting clean, it's a tactical weapon.
It's about survival, but not in the way you'd think. It's about surviving the hierarchy.
Exactly. So we have this account from Scott Anderson. He's in Helsinki with his companion, Elder Brunson, and they lucked out. They had an apartment with one of the best, hottest saunas in the city.
Which in a Finnish winter is like striking gold. It's the only place you can truly get warm.
For real. But they had this problem. The assistants to the president, you can think of them as like the mission's middle management.
Yeah, the guys who report directly to the top.
They love to drop by. And they weren't coming to relax. They were coming to talk goals.
Oh, this is the corporate side of missionary work colliding with reality. Numbers, projections,
How many doors did you knock?
efficiency. Nobody wants to have a performance review while they're wearing a towel.
No. So Elder Brunson, he develops this defense mechanism. When the assistants would start drilling them on numbers in the sauna, Brunson wouldn't argue. He'd just quietly pick up the ladle
Oh, I know where this is going.
and dump two or three massive scoops of water onto the rocks.
The nuclear option.
Instant searing steam. Scott Anderson says the heat would spike so aggressively that the assistants would be like rubbing their ears in pain. They would literally flee the sauna to escape.
And I'm guessing the conversation about quarterly projections just ended right there.
We never did make any goals while taking our sauna, is how he puts it.
It's funny, but it's also really insightful. It shows the autonomy these young guys had to sort of carve out for themselves. They're navigating this strict hierarchy, but they're using the local culture, the literal heat of Finland, to buy themselves some breathing room. It's a great example of adaptation. They were learning to be Finnish to survive their American bosses.
Speaking of adapting, there's another story that really highlights how these Americans had to pivot. We have to talk about Christmas and specifically Joulukki.
The Finnish Santa Claus, which is a very different beast from the American version.
Right. So Richard Rose shares this memory from the winter of 74. The mission president's wife asks him to dress up as Juupukki for their family. Now, Rose is an American. He's probably thinking he needs to be sneaky, invisible, leave presents.
Eat a cookie, yeah. But in Finland, Santa knocks on the front door. He's a guest.
Exactly. He had to walk right up, knock loudly, and enter the house. And it wasn't just ho ho ho. He had to engage in this traditional song with the children. He had to look them in the eye and ask if they'd been kilty. if they'd been good.
It's a face-to-face accountability session.
And Rose says he actually preferred it. It felt more real. Instead of some myth who vanishes, you have this direct interaction. For a young guy so far from home during the holidays, being invited into that family circle, that's significant.
It grounds them. It reminds you that they weren't just tourists. They were becoming part of the fabric of the place. But, and this is where the memoirs get really interesting, that immersion often hit a hard wall when it came to the actual rules of their faith.
The coffee wall.
The coffee wall.
Mm-hmm.
In Finland, I mean, coffee isn't just a drink, it's a national institution. It's how you socialize, how you show hospitality.
And for Latter-day Saints who abstain from coffee, that's a massive point of social friction.
It is. There's a story from Gary Carter in Him and Lena that just nails this. It's Vapu Pesai May Day, which is a huge celebration.
Everyone's out.
Yeah. They knock on a door. An older woman invites them in. She offers coffee. They decline. And she immediately says, "Oh, I know all about your church, but I could never join."
That's the salesperson's nightmare. The client who knows a product agrees it's good, but has a deal breaker on a single feature.
And her reasoning is just fascinating. She tells them, "I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. I know the Book of Mormon is true. I accept the theology. That's exactly why I can't join. I cannot give up the coffee."
That is such a human contradiction. She had the theological conviction, but stumbled on the lifestyle application.
Right. It challenges the assumption that people reject faith because of logic or some deep doctrinal issue. Sometimes it's just habit, or the social cost of being the one person who doesn't drink coffee with their friends.
She told them she'd been taught years before. Her husband had forbidden her from joining, then she just drifted. But now, years later, she was alone. Gary Carter and his companion didn't have to teach her the doctrine. She already knew it. They just had to help her over that one final caffeinated hurdle.
And she did it. She gave it up and was baptized. But I want to pause on the meta point here. Because Gary Carter reflects on the missionaries who taught her the first time, years ago.
Right.
Those guys went home thinking they failed. They logged that area as a zero. They never saw that seed grow.
Carter calls it the river of work.
It's beautiful imagery, isn't it? A strong, unbroken current carrying decades of faith. It pushes back on our need for instant results. In this context, success isn't always harvesting. Sometimes it's just planting and walking away, trusting the next person will handle the watering. It completely redefines success.
But sometimes, even when the harvest is ready, the infrastructure literally falls apart.
Oh, you're thinking of the rusty baptism.
I am. Let's stay in Him and Lena. Scott Lundberg arrives there later to reopen the area. It had been closed because it was so unproductive.
Mm-hmm.
They find a convert who is ready. He's been fellowshipped by local members. He's good to go. They go to fill the baptismal font, turn on the tap, and...
orange water.
Orange, brown, just murky sludge. The pipes hadn't been used for a baptism in so long, they'd rusted through. They tried boiling water in the kitchen to dilute it. Hopeless. They just had to proceed with this rusty water.
Wow. It's such a vivid symbol of neglect, isn't it? The spiritual machinery was there, but the physical machinery had just decayed.
And the kicker is, when Skate reported the baptism to his mission president, who, by the way, was Russell M. Nelson, the current president of the church, President Nelson, told him to quit joking.
He didn't believe it.
Literally did not believe there was a baptism in Him and Lena. The area was considered dead. He had to see the paperwork to believe it.
That says so much about the persistence required in these dry areas. You just keep showing up, even when the pipes are rusty and leadership thinks you're pranking them.
Right.
But I want to shift gears a little. We've talked about external challenges, rust, coffee, bureaucracy. But these memoirs also cover some really profound internal struggles.
Mm-hmm. The transformation of the soul. This isn't just about numbers. It's about people changing their entire worldview.
And we have to talk about Helena Ullman. Her story really stands out in these documents because it's so visceral. It's not a polite, gradual change. It's violent.
She describes visiting a chapel in Helsinki for the first time and feeling dirty. She says she actually wanted to, like, roll along the wall so no one would see her.
That's a powerful description of shame, or maybe just a spiritual mismatch. She felt visibly out of place, but then she sees a film about Joseph Smith, and she describes seeing a light. And she's very specific. This wasn't a metaphor. She saw a physical light she couldn't explain.
And the change was instant. She walked out, threw her cigarettes in the trash, and later said she felt like she was walking a meter above the street.
But here's the reality check. We often romanticize conversion as this happy ending. For Helena, it was the start of a family tragedy.
Yeah.
Conversion can tear families apart. When she decided to serve her own mission later, her father was devastated.
That part was hard to read. He told her, My best daughter has joined Satan's church, and when she left for the airport, he refused to help her with her suitcases.
He just stood there.
She had to carry her own bags out the door while he stood there, angry and silent.
Imagine the grit that takes. To love your father, to see his pain, but to have a conviction so strong that you pick up those suitcases and walk out alone. That's the definition of sacrifice. It's not just giving up coffee. It's risking your most important relationships.
And the payoff. She mentions in her memoir that her mustard seed grew into a huge tree. She served that mission. Her husband served. Her son served. It became a generational legacy. But it started with that lonely walk out the door.
It really raises an important question about what we're willing to sacrifice for what we believe. Helena's barrier was emotional. But then you have someone like Seppo, whose barrier wasn't emotional at all. It was intellectual.
Oh, Seppo. Jerry Olson's contact. This guy sounds intimidating to teach.
He really does. He represents the intellectual trap. He had read everything. The standard works. Jesus the Christ. A marvelous work. And a wonder. Jerry Olson says Seppo actually knew more about the church's history and doctrine than the young missionaries did.
But he wouldn't commit. He was stuck in the paralysis of analysis. He could argue the points, but he couldn't make the move.
Which is common, right? You can know all the facts and still miss the truth. You can be an expert on the map and still never take the trip. So the mission president gives them some advice that sounds counterintuitive. Stop debating facts. Challenge him to get his own answer through prayer.
And it almost failed. Seppo cancels the next appointment. The missionaries are totally discouraged. They think, okay, we pushed too hard. He's out.
But they go back one last time. And this is the cinematic moment. Seppo's in the kitchen making refreshments, and he yells out, read the book on the table.
He's talking about a book of memories, basically a guest book or a journal Jerry had left behind. And there, in Seppo's handwriting, it says, I believe that the gospel you preach is the true gospel of Jesus Christ.
He had to move from the head to the heart.
Mm.
And once he did, the intellect served the spirit instead of blocking it. It's a classic example of how different people need different P's to unlock that door.
Sometimes, though, the person has already unlocked the door themselves before the missionaries even knock.
The golden investigator.
A unicorn.
William James tells the story of Amo Ohala. They meet him in a totally random encounter. He's just a bachelor jogging in a park.
Which, in the 70s, was probably a bit eccentric on its own.
So they give him a Book of Mormon. 2 weeks later, they come back. And the missionary, William, he's skeptical. He asks, did you read it? Expecting a play. Oh, I read a little. But Amo says, yes, I read the whole thing. And the missionary doesn't believe him. So he quizzes him.
He does. He asks, what was your favorite part?
And Amo doesn't just say the beginning. He cites specific passages. He talks about the stones of the Jaredites in the Book of Ether. He talks about Alma's sermon on the seed.
These are deep cuts.
Totally. He didn't just read it. He devoured it.
And he was baptized, became a bishop, and later married a woman named Ann Torpo.
This connects right back to that river of work idea we talked about. The missionaries found him, yes. But Amo Ohala was already prepared. He was, in a sense, a fruit waiting to be picked. It reminds us that often the missionary's role is just to be in the right place at the right time to facilitate something that's already happening inside a person.
It takes the ego out of it.
It does. You're not the converter. You're the facilitator.
We also have a brief mention of a brother, Michaela, an electrical engineer. David Ryberry mentions him. Similar vibe. Very intellectual. Lots of questions that left the missionaries intellectually stranded.
I love that phrase, intellectually stranded. It's so humble. It's admitting that a 19-year-old kid cannot out-argue a seasoned engineer.
It is. But again, the solution wasn't a better argument. It was fasting. Brother Michaela found his answer through spiritual means, not engineering logic.
There's a pattern here. Whether it's the woman with the coffee, the intellectual Seppo, or the engineer Michaela, the barrier is rarely a lack of information. It's almost always about making that leap of faith. The data can only take you so far. Eventually, you have to jump.
Now, we can't talk about this specific era in Finland without talking about the visit.
August 1974, President Spencer W. Kimball.
For listeners who might not be familiar with the church's structure, having the president of the church come to Finland in the 70s was a massive deal. This is the prophet.
It's like the Pope visiting a small parish. Huge. And Mike Bosley describes the feeling in the building as if it were lifting off the ground. The energy was just palpable. It validated the work of every single person in the country.
But the story that really got me was from Daniel Harding. He was a missionary serving there.
The translator.
Yes. So Daniel is asked to translate for President Kimball because the Finnish sisters requested him specifically. He's sitting behind them, whispering the translation as Kimball speaks.
That is such a high-pressure situation. You are the voice of the prophet for these members. You cannot mess that up. The weight on his shoulders must have been immense.
So mid-talk, President Kimball leans over to the mission president, who whispers to an assistant, who then walks down to Daniel and asks, "President Kimball would like to know if you need a drink of water."
That's such a human moment. Here's a man revered as a prophet. He's addressing a multitude, and his concern is the throat of the young kid whispering in the back row.
It's so touching. And afterwards, President Kimball puts his hands on Daniel's shoulders and tells him he has the gift of tongues.
Which, for a missionary struggling with Finnish, again, this notoriously difficult language, that must have been incredibly validating. It turned a mechanical task into a spiritual confirmation.
But the coda to this story is wild. Years later, Daniel is back in Utah at a homecoming event. President Kimball is there. Daniel walks up, assuming the president won't know him from Adam.
Of course.
He starts to say, "You probably don't remember me."
And Kimball cuts him off.
"Helsinki, Finland."
That is remarkable. It just speaks to the intensity of those connections.
Ugh.
That trip clearly mattered to President Kimball just as much as it mattered to the missionaries. It wasn't just a tour stop. It was a core memory.
So when we look at this whole stack of stories, the saunas, the rusty water, the broken family ties, the jogging bachelor, the prophet's visit, what does this all mean? What's the big takeaway here?
You know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it really dismantles the idea of the super missionary. None of these people were superheroes. They were young, they were cold, they struggled with the language, and they sometimes, played pranks on their bosses in the sauna.
They were just people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But through that very ordinary human effort, extraordinary things happened. The recurring theme is that the work is bigger than the worker. You've got Gary Carter planting seeds with the coffee lady that he never sees grow. You have William James harvesting fruit that someone else, or maybe God himself, had been preparing in Aemo'ohala.
It's less about the individual achievement and more about being part of that flow.
Precisely. It's that image from Gary Carter again, the river. You step into the river, you do your part, and the current carries the work forward. You might not see the end result, but your effort matters because it keeps the river moving.
That's a powerful thought. Whether you're dealing with rusty pipes or stubborn intellectuals, you just keep the water moving.
And you trust that the seeds you plant in the cold of winter will eventually find their spring.
Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive. It has been a fascinating look into 1970s Finland.
It certainly has.
I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We talked a lot about the people who joined the church, Seppo, Helena, Aimo. But think about the people who didn't join, but who still had those interactions with these young Americans. Think about the legacy of those seeds that might still be dormant or perhaps bloomed in ways we don't have records for. How many stories are out there that never made it into a memoir but changed a life just the same?
A provocative thought indeed.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.